Welcome to Beyond the Code, the podcast where industry experts and brilliant legal minds discuss the impact of new emerging technologies. I'm your host, Yitzi Hammer, a lawyer and tech enthusiast. Join us as we explore the legal, regulatory, and ethical issues surrounding AI, blockchain, and more. Get ready to go beyond the code and stay ahead of the game.
Alon Gorin.
I love how you say that. Welcome to the podcast. This is a great honor to have you on.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's always cool because we met each other online, right? And then we saw each other at a conference in real life. And, you know, you look very similar to what your profile picture used to be. So it's perfect.
Actually, like, I feel like crypto events, I've aggregated a group of like really solid people. A lot of them I've had here on the podcast, and I've been like all around the world. I think one of my favorite things about becoming a crypto lawyer is crypto conferences. Like, there's no shortage of them. I always open up the calendar at the beginning of the year and just look like, where are the coolest places that I can go that my wife normally wouldn't let me go to, but I'll tell her that there's a conference going on there and it's for work and I have no choice. And then hit at one of these conferences, and it's usually like a tight knit group of people from all around the world that are in this ecosystem, and they come to various conferences. And as I've gone to different ones, and I've collected like this group of like really, really solid, a really solid network. And so, I'm really, really grateful that I've had the opportunity to have met you at one of your, I mean, I guess it was previously Draper Gorin Holm events. Yeah. And I even had the privilege of speaking at one of your events. It was at like one of the worst times for the crypto ecosystem. I think Bitcoin was at like $19,000 then or something, maybe even lower than that, just like to give you an indication as to where the ecosystem was at that point. FTX had just crashed, and it was really like the worst time to ever go to a crypto conference.
We managed to fill up
a room nonetheless.
Yeah, well, what we kind of did was we were really early in the space, and we had a conference way early that was called Crowd Invest Summit because we were in the crowdfunding space. And what was really fun is that I had that company in the crowdfunding space kind of had hit the end of its rope. Of course, the second we hit record, a trash truck or a big truck just pulled up. So
I can't even hear it. It's fine.
This crowdfunding conference, what was fun was my company in that space was kind of getting to the end of its life. But the people in the crowdfunding space were starting to talk about, you know, have you heard of these crowd sales that are happening on this thing called Ethereum? I knew about it because I actually, had done some experimentation as early as like 2013 with some crypto stuff, but more just experiments. But I learned about it from people like Tim Draper, and even more so from his son, Adam Draper, who I worked with at the time. So I knew about this crypto thing. And what was really funny is the last Crowd Invest Summit we did, we would always have, like, as you saw at our conferences later when we kind of even built it bigger and it was in the blockchain space and stuff, we had this area for media companies usually. Like, we would have some corner or some area where we would just give booths to anybody who was doing a YouTube channel or media company or anything in our space. And there was one year, you would especially appreciate this, where the crowd sales started happening. I think it was like the very beginning of 2017 or so, where the media people were not asking us to connect them with, you know, the big time CEOs or the Mark Cubans of the world or the people like that who would come and speak at our conferences. They were asking us to connect them with the securities attorneys. And there was
they knew where the trouble was coming from.
I remember, especially the funniest thing was, I still do this guy's TV show. It's called The Big Biz Show in San Diego. And I'm like one of the people who kind of Skype into it once a week, once every couple weeks, and we talk crypto on it and stuff. But back then, I remember he was going, who's the best securities attorney? And I was connecting him with, were the people at the time, right? Like Jor Law was still doing he was just starting verifyinvestor.com. So, you know, people know Jor Law in our space as being an early person at T0 at Prime Trust. He was a board member at Prime Trust. I think he was even their interim CEO. And so these are like early people that got into crypto and whatever. You know, these heads of these big law firms who wouldn't have shown up to a crowdfunding conference, but all of a sudden there's this crypto thing and there's a lot of money going on, the craziness and these Ethereum crowd sales happening. So all of a sudden the media companies were asking to meet with these people.
With securities lawyers.
Yeah. So we ended up changing our conference from Crowd Invest Summit to Crypto Invest Summit. Then later we realized the word crypto was a bad word with some people, and we wanted it to be more broad. So we changed to LA Blockchain Summit at one point, because we also realized the events aren't our full-time job. The, you know, investing in companies is. And so we didn't need to have a conference everywhere in the world. You know, we were cool with just LA. At the early days, when we were just starting, weren't sure if the conference was the business or even what the business was. So we kept it broad because we were like, maybe we'll start doing these around the world.
Right. And, so is it, I was always curious about it. Is the conference a business in and of itself, or is it just something to drive traffic to the fund?
No. Yeah. So what, at the beginning days of crowdfunding, we didn't know what crowdfunding would become. It was partly, hey, could we make this a business? And then could we make it pay for itself? And then it's like an advertisement for our existing businesses, because I had a company called Invested In, which actually Tim Draper was an investor in. My partner at the time, Joseph, had a company called Crowdster, and he wanted to kind of promote that product. And so we kind of just went, if this conference could pay for itself, and we basically did the opposite of what you did. Because crowdfunding conferences weren't that exciting like crypto conferences anyway, we were at, like, you know, at the restaurant bar or at the bar at, you know, a crowdfunding conference in like Orlando, Florida. And I'm like, don't you live like an hour away from me? And he's like, yeah. I go, why do we always meet up at these, you know, a crappy bar at a hotel conference in some random in Vegas or in Orlando or wherever, Washington, D.C., places where, you know, Washington, D.C. was kind of cool. But, you know, when you just fly in and fly out for a conference, it wasn't that cool. And so we were like, why don't we just start our own in L.A. so we don't have to travel for it, and then people come to us. And that's how we kind of started it. But then you know how crypto goes. You started this conversation with, you spoke at one of the worst times. And, you know, it was it's such a funny thing, but it's a roller coaster, right? And we have these cycles of up and down, the halvings and the various regulatory issues and the trends and
the hype, bulls and the bears,
the sure. bull markets, the bear market. So we had some times where our conference would land, you know, at in a bull market time, and it would be somewhat profitable. And then we'd have ones where it's in bear market times where we take the cash that was at the profitable one to pay for the next one. And at the early days, we were actually doing two conferences a year, which was also just really stupid because it took up too much effort and they kind of cannibalized each other. And it was just really hard during a time when the market didn't exist yet. But then we learned to optimize it. We did it a little better, but the last conference was kind of tough because we had these scaling ideas during bull market times of, hey, next conference, let's make it 3 days long. Let's kind of do this one day, do this another day, and we'll kind of separate into these mini conferences. We had these ideas, and you kind of get going on the train and you don't really you lose sight of what it's all about. And it was such a slog to make it cover expenses. It was so hard to fill the room, make it work right, that we didn't do some basic things that would have made the conference way better. But more importantly, you know, and this is, you know, letting people behind the curtain, the best, most important part of the conference for me is there's a section of our conference that we call a pitch stage, and we let companies tell us what they want to pitch on that stage a few months in advance, and we pick the best companies and or the most exciting pitches or you know, whatever. And I get to meet those companies months before they release something publicly. They tell me about the thing they're going to release months before. So I get all this fun information of meeting with these entrepreneurs, and I get to find out what they're going to do in advance. And as a job of being an investor, especially a super early stage investor, which is what we've set ourselves up to be, I get to meet all these people before anyone else does. So I get to see the deal first. And sometimes we do the deal. And then by the time they get up on our stage, we can help them get to the next level or amplify their message or whatever. The last time I was so focused on doing the conference that I met some of the investors, like our team. We had our team checking the pitches and stuff like that. And a few of the people I knew. So it was like kind of easy. And our team told me about it. And some of the people would tell me about it. And ooh, that sounds cool. But a lot of the entrepreneurs I met for the first time at the conference, which for me is the worst time because I'm running, taking care of business. You know, I'm making sure I shake your hand because you were just speaking on stage. And I'm not like undivided attention with the entrepreneur, which is my favorite thing in the world to do. So we've learned some things, and we actually paused the events for a moment. But I think I'm going to start doing more purposeful events again, and maybe even opening something bigger up again once we're set up to do it more properly. But we've done them in the craziest times, right? We did right at the peak of the time when Bitcoin hit 20K or so. And it was crazy, right? And then a few months later, we did another one. We had Steve Wozniak speaking about crypto up on stage. And it was like the worst times market-wise, but it still was a pretty successful conference from the perspective people wanted to come and see. But then we've had ones that are just, I have a feeling that what's interesting about the moment right now, and I'm a huge fan and I'm a huge fan of Lunar Crush. I was going to mention I'm an investor in them. They're one of those people I met early at our conference before they ever launched, before they even quit their day jobs to start the company. We met them at our conference. So that was a value of the conference. But they have all of the data, especially when it comes to social and crypto. And if you look, people aren't yet even talking about Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin sitting at all-time high price of all times, you know, not like this year's all-time high ever, right? And people are still not talking about them even close to a fraction of what they did in the previous all-time high. Like people have gotten used to Bitcoin doing this stuff. And when that happens, it's going to be crazy. And I think it's probably going to happen later this year with the halving and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, Bitcoin will blow past like 100K or get to some crazy amount as it blow the normal people's minds.
All you have to do is coordinate a conference with that 100K mark and you'll be fine.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. You never know. But also the conference, right? I think a conference in this space, if you kind of became the big conference, there's a few big, I learned doing conferences, there's a few big like tech conference holding companies that when conferences get to a certain size, they buy them and they know how to amplify them. They know how to do the ticket sales and all that stuff. It's really not for me, right? It's not my business, not what I get excited about. I do love, you know, filling the room and I love the excitement, whatever, but I'll fill the room with free people as long as they do something. Like we had cool promotions back in the day with groups like eToro, where they went like, if you get the app and you put in a deposit $100, you know, they would give you some money in return. So we did a deal with them and said, hey, give us a part of that money and we'll just give a free ticket to every person who downloads the app and deposits $100. So less than the cost of buying a ticket to our conference, buy $100 worth of Bitcoin, we'll give you a free ticket to the conference. And basically eToro paid for their ticket, right? Or paid a fraction. But for us, we don't care because I would rather get more people to buy Bitcoin than to pay for me to get a ticket to my conference. And if I can fill the room with those people, amazing.
Yeah, you're golden.
Think about like 2 years ago, being able to go, there's 3,000 people in this room and every single one of them owns Bitcoin. Even today, that's unheard of. Back then it was even crazier. So that was what was exciting about the conference for me. And of course, meeting the companies and getting to own a piece of certain ones in advance was really exciting for me too.
Okay, and so now I want to just stop you for a second. So who the heck are you? Like, how did you get to this point where you're like bringing Steve Wozniak up onto a stage at your conferences, and how are you like, you know, like investing early stage in companies? Like, where did you come from? How did you
find yourself into this world? You know, I'm a techie nerd, right? So, all the way back, right? Because we talked a little bit about this before we went live, like our families and our backgrounds stuff. But my parents are immigrants to the United States. They came here basically on their honeymoon, and I'm the youngest of three boys. And my dad owned an auto parts shop, right? But my my brother, who's in the middle, who's 4 years older than me, he was a techie. So I was looking over his shoulder while he was on AOL and doing things like that when we were little kids. And you know, was just a techie nerd, but grew up with parents, with at least my dad's an entrepreneur, right? Like, you know, have our own business, do our thing. And so to me, no matter where I worked, I always had some side hustle or some idea of a company I wanted to start. So when I was able to finally leave my dad's shop, when, you know, at a certain age, you know, I snuck out because I had to make deliveries, right? Because if I'm making deliveries, you don't have to pay someone to make deliveries. So at a certain point, I was able to sneak off. And every job I had, I was on the side, you know, writing notes, trying to figure something out. So as a teenager, that was like starting my own record label for punk bands and stuff like that. But it was all tech forward, right? So we were always... So like I was one of the first ones of my friends to like make a website for our band, or even like join MySpace and do that kind of thing, which I got a job as a teller at a bank while I was going to college. Then my next job was, and while I was at that job, I figured out how to hack the computer so that I could VPN to my computer at home and work on stuff on my computer at home while I was sitting there pretending to work at the bank. Then I got a job at Countrywide, actually, right before the financial crisis. And still, it was part-time, so I could still go to school full-time. And while I was at Countrywide, I was in the systems architecture group. So I was in the computer nerd group, but I was just in a system.
How old are you then?
I must have been 20 years old or so, 21, 22. I'm not sure. Somewhere around that age, because I was still
part-time. What were you studying?
I was studying business at school. So I thought I was really smart because my older brother went to school for computer science and he was being begged to quit school to work more hours at every tech company he worked for as an engineer. So I thought, I'll go to school for business. It's way easier than computer science. And then I won't have to. And then because
you can actually finish your degree.
People could hire me. Yeah, none of the people would hire me care if I have a degree in computer science. So I thought it was like complimentary, but really it was top out because I didn't like school. I wasn't good at it. I didn't care. I wanted to work. And then while I was at Countrywide, some friends of mine told me about their company that was bought by MySpace. And they were moving from New York to LA to work at MySpace. And they said that one of their guys wasn't going to move from New York to LA, just didn't want to, wasn't going to get paid enough, whatever the reason, he wanted to stay in New York. And so they said, come interview here to work for us at MySpace. We just got acquired. So, you know, whatever. And I went, cool, I could work at MySpace. I went, did that job interview, and I actually got the job at MySpace. And I convinced them to let me work slightly different hours, but I couldn't convince them to let me be part-time. So at that point, I went to school at night. Which I kind of regret for different reasons, but it's a different source. I worked at MySpace. It was the height of MySpace's powers. Like, it was right after their acquisition from Fox. They went on a buying spree. And it was also the height of LA tech also, because all of these engineers were being hired from all around the world to move to LA to work for MySpace. So when MySpace had their demise, all those folks were starting all these startups in LA. It was pretty great. And LA, it was like, to at least for our generation or so, it was like how LA got a ton of engineers and techies.
How long did that like MySpace thing last for? I remember like I as there. Like a teenager, I feel like it was very short lived. Like, I got on MySpace and I got right off.
Yeah. So it was I got there and then they hit the height of their powers at some point when I was there. They got to like it was something like they were the most trafficked website on the internet for a minute, like more traffic than Google, which was crazy. And then there was a few months or so of them being that, like, the most traffic thing. And then I think they cannibalized their own product, because when they started advertising like movies on their homepage, that advertising buy, I remember talking to the sales team people for a studio or group to buy that homepage on MySpace, it was $1 million a day ad buy. And then they had all the rest of the ads on MySpace. They were making tons and tons and tons of money selling ads, but they were doing stupid crap with the product, like to make you hate the product. Like if you were idle for like 2 minutes, they'd log you out so that you would have to look at the homepage again so they could pump the numbers of people seeing that homepage ad so that they could sell it for more money. But the more you do stuff like that, the more people left to Facebook and better products, people who focused on a good product versus just milking.
Making advertising money. Right?
So I was there for like 3 years or so. And then I was graduating school. And finally, when I knew I was graduating school, I didn't really like working at MySpace. I liked a few of the people there, but it was, for me also, it was in Beverly Hills and I live in the suburbs. So it was like well over an hour commute each way. And that kind of sucked. And when I finished school and I didn't have to work weird hours to go to school at night, I started applying for other jobs and I got a job at a group, a company that was acquired by IMDb, by the Internet Movie Database, which is owned by Amazon. So I got to work in that environment for a few years. But while I was working there, I actually started my crowdfunding company on the side with my old friend from MySpace. And we were building this crowdfunding company. And eventually, when it got to the point where I could raise money for a startup and figure it out, whatever, I stopped working there. But I was still there for probably 3.5-4 years or so at Amazon, which was really cool to work for them. And then I started doing the crowdfunding, and crowdfunding is what got me into this idea of early stage startups and everything, right? It made me
want. So then you started Invested In, you called it, right?
Yeah, it's called Invested In. It was a crowdfunding platform for startups. Well, first it was
equity-based crowdfunding.
So we didn't know. So I will tell you, when I launched that company, I didn't know what public solicitation was. I had no idea it was illegal to raise money on the internet. And when we first did our initial launch, we publicly launched it in 2010. It was still pre the Jobs Act, before the Jobs Act and being allowed to raise money on the internet for startups, before Regulation CF and all of those rules. Those were 2012. Or at least Obama signed it in 12, and then it took some time for the SEC to write the rules and all the stuff. But so what ended up happening was I realized what we wanted to do was illegal. We couldn't raise money for startups on the internet the way we wanted to. And so we became a white label provider for people wanting to build different online investment platforms or rewards-based crowdfunding sites. So they'd be like, somebody would come to me and be like, I want to launch the Kickstarter for comic books, and we would help them launch it. Or this is how I met Adam Draper, Tim Draper's son. He actually launched a crowdfunding platform for equity, for only for accredited investors at first because of legal reasons and stuff. And that's how I met Adam, Tim Draper's son. And that's actually how I kind of got I started to learn about crypto. That's where the seed was starting to be planted because of him.
So, but you also could have just restricted your sales to your investments to accredited investors, no?
So what was interesting is it was partly because we had full-time jobs at the beginning too. You couldn't really launch a consumer brand while sitting in a cubicle working for somebody else, right? So there, you know, what we kind of did was we built this platform, we got it working really well, we made the product really awesome. And then by the time we were ready to quit our day jobs to really go full-time,
made a securities lawyer.
Had launched, AngelList had just started. So all of a sudden, the word crowdfunding became a thing. Because when we started, the word crowdfunding didn't exist.
You guys were before Indiegogo and Kickstarter?
Yeah, we were publicly launched before both of them. But we both had full-time jobs at the time. They really took some wind out of our own sails because there was something in the air. Also, like everyone knew this was the future, because even when I worked at MySpace, the idea of this spawned, the way you would fundraise, I remember there was a widget people would put on their page that was like, it was called like Chip In or something like that. And it was basically like a thermometer. It literally looked like a thermometer, you know, like at schools where they put a thermometer and they're like, let's get to the top, you know, and each time you raise money, it literally was that for your MySpace page and your Facebook page and stuff like that. And it connected to your PayPal account. Every time somebody sent you money on PayPal, it would move up the notch. And so this stuff was happening. Like, we bought domains for this stuff, like called social fundraising, because we thought, oh, social fundraising, that's what it's going to be called. And then the word crowdfunding came out, which was way better marketing. And so, you know, a bunch of these companies were launching at the same time. So we did build a pretty good business providing technology for these folks. But what we actually saw, we started looking at the data. We were receiving at one point 10 inquiries a day, inbound leads from people saying, I want to launch an online investment site or a crowdfunding site for X. Like 10 a day of people saying they want to launch these new businesses. So at a certain point, I had hundreds of these inquiries that had come in, maybe even thousands a couple years in. And I mined the data and I organized the data and I went, okay, there's a ton of people doing Kickstarter for X, right? Kickstarter for comic books, Kickstarter for musicians, Kickstarter for medical research, whatever, all these different ones. I remember we built a site for somebody called CrowdCure, right? Where it was like scientific research, right? For nonprofits. And then we looked at that and then we felt that at the time, one of the best categories, and I still think it's a good category, was crowdfunding for real estate. Because to me, the way I felt about it was, when I saw companies raise money online, back then especially, there was no culture in the United States. It's actually something that my Israeli family members, one of the big differences, right? There wasn't a culture in the United States about taking risk for starting a startup or to even invest in a startup. Like, I remember when I quit my day job to start my own company, I remember every American family member, every American friend, people from like more my wife's side of the family and friends I grew up with were like, you quit? And I went, yeah, I'm starting my own company. And they're like, oh, so that job sucked. And I'm like, no, it's a great job. You weren't getting paid very much? No, actually, it was great. And I was getting Amazon stock every quarter because I worked there for 4 years. And they were like, so your boss was an asshole? I'm like, no, best boss I ever had. And they were like, so why did you quit? I'm like, I'm starting my own company. That's why I quit. I want to do something, right? And then every Israeli family member would be like, they would just be like, kol hakavod, mazal tov. They never even questioned it. Like, why would you stay at a job when you can start a company? And it's just the differences in cultures was in that culture is like starting a startup was exciting. Is it almost a little bit like it's like almost like patriotic? It's like it's a more risk taking society for obvious reasons. You're raised a different way. And in the American culture, it wasn't yet a thing, right? And so when people were crowdfunding for startups online, you could get your mom, your sister, your brother, maybe your best friends to invest in it, but to raise money on the internet for a company and to explain to your buddy from high school, what do I get when I give you $100, right? Like, you get a share of stock in my company. Like, what does that mean? You own a piece of my company. So am I ever going to get my $100 back? Like it was confusing and people don't fully get it. And the fact that it's private share and it's not liquid was confusing to people. And it just wasn't a part of the culture like it is today. There was no thing like Wall Street bets and things like that where there was even a young culture of investing. So I thought the only category that made sense so far online was real estate, right? Because at least if you go to my mom and you don't know my mom, you could serve her an ad on Facebook. Like, you know that Starbucks that you and Judy and Hannah walk to every morning to get coffee and then walk back home? You know that building that the Starbucks is in? You could buy a piece of that building on this website right now. That everyone understands because everyone was raised to go like own real estate. That's how the wealthy people make more money. You own a piece. So to me, I felt like this is something you could sell on the internet. But there was a big category of people doing it well. And at the time, there's people like Realty Mogul and others who were doing a really good job in that. And so as I'm looking through the data and stuff, I realized there's like one underserved interesting category to me, which was funds, larger funds and groups, not doing individual deals. But what I learned was there was a category of people who would reach out to us saying, we've reached a certain level. We now have multiple funds that are a VC fund or a real estate fund that are in the level of a few $100 million raised. And now we can afford technology to make it more efficient. So like, instead of sending docs to each one of our investors, now, you know,
I mean, like investing as a service,
2013, we can send them docs digitally now, and we can have a website that has the information about our fund instead of just sending a presentation, and we can get the data of who actually clicked on the link. And if Yitzi sends a loan, this link for our fund, I know who to give credit to, of who introduced them, and I can see if they read the docs, I can see if they signed the docs, I can see, you know. So people were coming to us with that, and I thought, ooh, that's an interesting category, because what we learned is we were like a premium enterprise service provider for the space. We didn't want to do like a WordPress widget, self-serve, super, super cheap. We realized the category where it made the most sense for us would be enterprise service. And we experimented with all this stuff. And so we thought, what if we created a platform like that? And we called it Invest. And remember, there was a moment in time where short links were important because of Twitter and stuff like that, the character count. So we actually owned the domain name at the time, inv.st. And we thought, this is perfect. What we were going to do was we were going to create a private network. Again, privacy was important for securities laws. And so then it became, okay, we'll make this a feature, we'll lean in. Private network for accredited investors only, for the funds they want to invest in and the products they want to invest in. And we knew that most of the products would fit in a certain range. They would be bigger than the small deals on crowdfunding sites, but they'd be smaller than the multi-billion dollar funds who can afford their own technology, right? There's right in the middle, there's a bunch of real estate funds and VC funds that are in the $100 million to $300 million range that only accredited investors are allowed to invest in. We can create this private network. But more importantly, what we realized is that for every real estate fund and for a lot of VC funds and other types of funds, there is a middleman there. There's a person who is either a banker or some licensed individual, if it was being done legally and we only wanted to deal with legal stuff, that is actually getting paid a commission to introduce investors to the fund. And, you know, there's certain licensing in the United States, like a Series 7 or Series 63 or banking license that allowed you to make these introductions. And so what we wanted to do was, it was way too ahead of its time, and I'll explain to you why, and this is also what parlayed me into crypto, is that we thought, okay, if my friend Mike, I'll give you a comment. Mike is an investment banker, and he specializes in real estate funds, and he has a Rolodex, right? He has his Rolodex. That's his livelihood, that Rolodex. Those people who he gets to invest in his deals are his livelihood. And we thought, you know, he makes 5% or whatever his percentage is when he introduces $10 million investor to that real estate fund. And that might be one of two deals he does all year long, right? And that's what he lives for. He does those deals and he gets paid a commission. Maybe he does a lot of them and he owns a smaller piece. I don't know. And then there's other people that specialize in other types of deals. But what we realized is Mike's Rolodex, every person who is a very wealthy investor that invests $1 million in funds doesn't only invest in one type of fund, right? They diversify. But Mike is their real estate guy. What if Mike can introduce them to the platform to invest in the real estate deal, but because Mike is the one that introduced him to this platform, can he get credit if that investor invests in a VC fund on the platform? And the legal way to do that amongst bankers is to create it's called a co-marketing agreement. And you can legally do it and you can say, you know what, if Mike introduces somebody to me and they invest in my fund that me as a banker represents, I'll split my fees with him, this percentage to this percentage, whatever it is. And that makes it legal for Mike to introduce somebody to John, because John has the VC fund and he does the real estate fund. And maybe they do deals like that together. But that's very one-off with each other. But if I have a platform where I know every single investor on this platform that came from Mike, as long as he still holds his license, and John does the same thing on his deals, and as long as he still holds his license, I can be licensed and have a marketing agreement amongst all the bankers on here. If it's your deal, you get 100% of the fees for the investors you bring. If somebody else brings an investor, you split the fees with them some percentage, right? And so I wanted to make this platform for mostly for those people that had the Rolodexes. So I was calling it, like, I was going to people saying, this is how you get return on Rolodex.
Rolovest.
I thought there would be a land grab to invite all of your investors to the platform first, because the first person who invites an investor to the platform gets credit for that person.
He owns that investor, yeah.
So that was the scheme I had created. Still, nobody's built this platform. Somebody should build this. I will help you build it if somebody out there is listening and wants to build this platform. Because here's the thing. This thing ultimately failed. And the reason it failed, there were some internal things. My partner had gone on to new things. So I became the CTO, and I'm not a good CTO. And then there was nobody running around like a chicken with their head cut off selling the product like me. So it failed for a few reasons, but one of the reasons it failed when we launched it originally is still no one trusted me, right? How do you create trust in this third party, in this startup? Because they go, oh, I introduce everybody to Elon. I don't know for sure if I'll get credit when the other person invests.
And right? Then there you go. I just like burned my greatest asset.
I burned my biggest, most valuable asset, right? And this is a common thing because this happens all the time. And even amongst bankers, right? They go like, you know, they make introductions and then they hope that the investor doesn't tell the other person that they made the investment and they don't send the fees and they do, or they do it illegally. And then there's nothing and there's no recourse, right? But in the world of legal solicitation and legal fundraising and whatever, you still, there's a lot of people who just go, oh, I forgot. I forgot that you introduced me to that.
Well, not if it's on chain.
That's where we're at now. So that company failed and I worked for a VC fund for a while. One of the investors in my company said, you know, you'd be a great VC. You should come hang out with me, be a good venture partner, introduce me to companies and whatever. So I learned a lot about VC working for Eric Manlunis from Wavemaker, wavemaker.vc. They're like one of the world's most active early stage investors. So I also learned the
what year is this now?
This is
just place me like in terms of like where
2015, okay. 2016 or so. Yeah. And what's really cool about learning all that and being early in the space, you know, I'm doing that, I'm doing our conferences, and then sometime around 2017, 18, I met Ami Ben David, the founder of Onera. But I met him when he was a part of Spice VC and Securitize. Spice VC was one of the first, they were the first fully tokenized VC fund. Blockchain Capital tokenized their fund ahead of them, but they didn't tokenize the whole fund, just a portion. Spice VC around the same time did the whole fund. So they're around the same time, but essentially they're the first, one of the first VC funds that are tokenized. And there was no product to tokenize their funds. So they created a thing called Securitize. Securitize is doing well right now. They just announced, like, they did the BlackRock thing just now.
Yeah.
And Securitize still exists. But I remember arguing with Ami and the Securitize team and the Spice VC team at one of our conferences saying, I don't think that these private things are going to scale very well on Ethereum. That was the argument, right? And there's ways now, there's some privacy things and there's some stuff and Ethereum is holding its weight in the private shares too. But I think Ethereum is suited best for public stuff. And most of the private things are private for a reason, right? The bankers and the institutions want to hold their power, which I don't like, but that's my practical feelings of, because obviously I'm all in on transparent everything, because one of the reasons why I love on-chain. But anyway, when I'm arguing with Ami, we argued about it. We got along great. Well, here's the thing. Ami is an Israeli. So what I always say, and you're an Israeli, so you'll understand this. I always joke with people that there is no one I argue with most than people I agree with. And the only and you know this because I'm an Israeli, because Israelis argue. Like it's the joke, right? That we always argue and whatever. I was raised by Israelis. I was born and raised in America, so I got the best and worst of both worlds.
And then after you chew each other's heads off, you give a big
after
hug
we
and
argue
say,
about it. We're best and friends, right? if I was arguing with an American, I probably wouldn't have argued the same way. Usually you can get the vibes that you're stepping on toes and maybe you're being disrespectful. But with an Israeli, we're arguing about it. And every moment of argument makes me like the person more and makes me feel more comfortable and more like they're my family, right? Maybe this is not, this is cultural, right? So a week
in
or two later.
In Israel, it's always like, I love you, brother, but you're a complete asshole. It starts with like,
you're screaming at each other, you hate them, and then you stand up and you give them a hug and a kiss, and I'll see you next week, right? Like, we joked about this about a different subject before we went live. So some time went by. I don't remember if it was a week or two. It might have been a couple months, but I have a Zoom call with Ami. Ami is in London. I'm in the United States. And he's telling me, he's like, I think maybe, you know, there needs to be a blockchain that's partly private, partly public. You know, there's this thing called Hyperledger that was happening. IBM was building a private blockchain. Maybe, you know, there's something to doing private and public. And we started debating this topic on like a Zoom call when we were just connecting with each other. And a half hour conversation turned into like me turning my camera and whiteboarding ideas. And he started talking about it. Instantly, that idea of Invest, that company I tried to build, the problem was trust, right? And I went, holy crap, if a blockchain for ownership existed, is before the word, before Onera was the name of his company, we said a blockchain for ownership, if that existed, we'd be able to launch that product. People would trust that on chain somewhere where they could verify that Alon was introduced to this platform. This is Alon's unique identifier. We did KYC, like his social. So this is his no matter what the email address is, this is Alon. He's on the platform. And for the life of him, as long as I stay licensed, any deals he does on this platform, I get a piece of. You know, that can be verified today with something like an immutable blockchain, right? And so I went, if this blockchain existed, this product launched. I started finding like old slides and explaining to him. And I said, and I'm going, this is crazy huge opportunity. This is not just all private shares, but if you just look at the United States at the time, the alternative investment space in the United States alone was like $7 trillion in size, right? It's crazy, right? It's basically opening up the world to blockchain technology. And this again is like 2018 or so. And we start, we got to build this. And then we start experimenting. We create this concept called Onera. We start to go, hey, who could be the CTO? Who could be this? And we start like talking about it and building it. And then pointing at each other, who's going to be the CEO? I go, I got a full-time job. I'm starting this thing. And he goes, well, I got a full-time job. And eventually I won that argument. And I'm glad I did, because now where Onera is amazing, and Ami is the right person to run it, and I would not be the right person to run it. I'm good at getting from zero to one and to a certain place, but he's taking it to a whole different level. And he built Onera, which at the beginning was the blockchain for ownership, but now has evolved into, you know what we realized is there's Ethereum, there's all these different implementations, there's JP Morgan's system, there is every layer two, there's all these other blockchains, and for certain use cases they make sense. And that's how it's going to be, just like there's a NASDAQ and there's a New York Stock Exchange and there's a Deutsche Börse and there's a London Stock Exchange, there's the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange. All those things are going to exist, but I need to be able to invest in any product from those exchanges in my from my Schwab account, right? And that's those rails need to exist for blockchain, because right now, when you go to when you went to invest in early days of something like Blockchain Capital, I don't remember if it was T0 or Open Finance. There was a few different places to deal with these, but to invest in those products, to buy those shares, it was actually harder than buying a piece of paper at first, because it was tokenized. You had to take your money, transfer it to a certain place, make an account at a new exchange, buy it at that exchange, leave it at that exchange. And when you wanted to transact, you had to go to that place. You made it harder, right? So what?
And there's more trust also, because you have to still trust the custodian.
That's right. You need to create a, what they wanted to do is create an open source interoperability layer. And so they created something called FinP2P that actually allows you to transact across all of the jurisdictions, across all of the banks and institutions, no matter which blockchain they're using. right? And that's what they ultimately ended up building. That's what they're working on now. And they're working with major financial institutions to do it, right? But like, these things happen as the industry grows, because, you know, think about 2018, we did something called Security Token Summit back then, and we did one every year since then. And some of the banks actually sent people, to their credit, to those 2018 Security Token Summits, right? Like, we had people from major financial institutions there, but none of them actually did any sort of implementation until pretty much this year. And even the implementations they're doing are still just kind of announcements of implementations. So it's still crazy, crazy early. But that's also what brought me into being a VC, right? Those kind of deals and opportunities. I love the early stage. I would any day of the week love to create an idea from scratch like that versus invest in a company that's already existed for a year or two and just, here's my money, I'm going to watch from the sidelines. So that's why the conference was valuable to us. And that's why I love to participate in the community. And I joke, like, different kind of participation on Twitter versus LinkedIn, right? Twitter is degen, goofy ape version of me having fun with community members. And that's what gives me the street cred to participate with them. And then there's the LinkedIn version where we be professional.
The more mature version.
Well, I have to do two things in my job, and I'm not saying I'm doing any of this right now. I'm not soliciting and all of the legal disclaimers of all that stuff. But as
NSA, NLA,
as a managing partner at a VC style firm, whether it's our venture studio or a fund that we might manage, my job is to do two things: is to raise money from investors so that I have the money to invest, because I'm not wasn't raised with generational wealth or anything like that. I hope my kids are, but I wasn't. And then, so it's not my own money. It's some of my own money, but it's a lot of other people's money. And then I have the second side is I have to find the right deals and entrepreneurs. And the better the crypto deal, or the more down the rabbit hole of crypto an entrepreneur is, the less they trust a venture capitalist. So they're not going straight to the big VCs.
That was my next question.
they need somebody like me as a wingman, or I hope they feel they need somebody like me as a wingman to navigate that world for them. And that's part of why I get in super early with some of the entrepreneurs.
So that brings me to my next two questions, okay, which I'll ask because they kind of go hand in hand. So number one, so you become a VC. But not just any VC, because you initially invest also in crypto, like through DJH, and now yes, presumably only in crypto because you're called Draper Gorin Blockchain. So yeah. I imagine that your mission statement is to invest in blockchain companies. Wait, don't answer me yet. I'm not ready yet. Okay. So number one, what kind of challenges do you face investing only in blockchain companies? I know we have a local blockchain VC here that I often work with, Collider VC, and one of their biggest challenges is that crypto companies typically want to sell tokens, not equity. And when you're and not a lot of investors, you know, not a lot of LPs want their money to be invested in tokens, where you have a lot less guarantees and corporate governance. And you know, your money could just up and go like a fart in the wind. So number one, what are some of the challenges that you face as a crypto-centric VC? Yeah. Then put that aside. Yeah. Don't answer yet. I'm not ready. Just one more question, okay? I wonder if you mentioned that there's the trust element, getting these companies to trust you. I wonder if the fact that you have a Bored Ape endears you to some of the crypto degens that you may invest in.
Yeah. Now you can answer. Well, first off, yeah, the DGH thing, what's funny about that is we were doing our conference, and I was pushing so hard with certain companies to my old partner to go, we should own a piece of that company. Let's do a deal with them. Let's let them just be at the conference for free and get some equity. Let's figure it out. And I convinced him to do that in some cases. And at the time, there was a lot of people with tokens, right? And they just wanted to pay us with tokens for the conference like they could with other conference organizers. And we didn't want to deal with that. We weren't interested in their pump and dump kind of schemes. It was partly a way to do due diligence on a company by saying, no, just pay us in dollars legally and properly, and that's it. It was partly made it easier for us to cover the expenses of the conference, but we could have made a lot of money and done a lot of conference organizers who've come and go made tons of money. And a part of me is very jealous, right? They got tokens from all sorts of companies that they knew that those companies were going to launch on stage at their events, and they dump the tokens immediately with the founders, you know, when those happen. But we didn't participate in those things. And that in the short term probably hurt us, you know, our pocketbooks, and it was a tough business. But in the long term, it helped us
build. You can't call yourself a security token summit and then go and pump and dump tokens on stage.
Exactly.
In the US.
We'd be the worst people. Plus, also, I am an early stage startup person. I learned and understood the game. And I know that early stage startup, you know, is a 10-year horizon, right? If you're in a pre-seed round, you shouldn't expect an exit, if at all, for 10 years, right? So I want to have a career beyond the hypey markets of a couple years. There's a lot of people we know in our space that for the rest of their life, you're going to Google them and you're going to see these issues. Whether or not they got in real trouble or not, they're going to have that, oh, they're one of those guys on their resume. And you don't want to be that. I want to have a career forever, right? My career is going to, and I need to have a long reputation. It's why I love people like Tim Draper, because he's him and he's been him forever. And he's long and he's always honest and upfront and transparent about it, same way we are. So anyway, you know, we started that by accident, right? We started DGH by just building. And it was when we got Tim to invest at the beginning, we went, look, we did our conference. We got, you know, 7-8 portfolio companies at the time. Now we're going to raise some money to do this properly and scale the business. And that's when we rebranded to include the Draper name on it. And that's when he invested in us the first time. And then we raised a fund later. And then as we got to the end of that fund, I decided to change some things up and kind of reorganize a little bit and start this new version where it was purposely built from scratch to build what we ultimately did build before. But now we're building, in my opinion, a better version. And we're doing some things structurally from a legal standpoint that I think is better for all people involved and all that. But one of the things that you mentioned is DGB, adding the blockchain word to our thing. One of the first things that happened to us was through our relationships and stuff, we easily opened a new bank account. We opened one at JP Morgan through a connection. We started raising some money for this new entity. We put money in it. And then out of nowhere,
your bank accounts got frozen.
Online banking stopped working. And we started calling them and asking questions, and they wouldn't give us an actual reason why. Still to this day, maybe we're just being weird and sensitive, but somebody said that they typically don't allow VCs in general to bank with them. But we think because the word That's blockchain was in the name, if it was VCs, they would have said, you know, it's too risky, right? The fact that they didn't put any reasoning for any of the compliance things makes me go, they're covering their butt so that they didn't get sued by a crypto company going, because the word blockchain was in it, you denied a service. But anyway, that was the first challenge. But I think that the next challenge of being purely in the blockchain space is what I mentioned before and what you started to allude to with the Bored Ape is, for good reason, the blockchain space, a lot of it, especially DeFi and stuff like that, I should talk a little bit about equity versus tokens too. But a lot of people got into this space because they don't trust the traditional banks, right? They don't trust the traditional venture capital landscape. That's part of why they wanted to have crowd sales and fair, why the purest nerd real people, not the people who took advantage, right? Because there was a lot of crowd sales that were BS, right? I would say a majority were, right? But there were real entrepreneurs and real intellectuals. Like, one of the things about the the blockchain and crypto space, I'm sure you'll agree on, is, and when you get into the room with the true believers, you've probably like for me, I never felt so stupid in my life, right? Every time I thought I understood something, there's a whole new layer, and it's all like, you know, math based and engineering based. And these are the smartest people I've ever met in my whole entire life in any category, right? They're scientists and engineers and mathematicians, basically, right? Like the Vitalik's of the world, right? He's kind of like a figurehead, but you hear him speak. And for every one of him, there's 100 others that are similar that you meet at our events and at conferences. And you're like, whoa, like these people are so smart, right? And so you want to be with them and you want to be a part of what they do. But the reason why they're in this space is because they don't trust the system, or they want to build a better system, right? And so they don't trust the traditional VCs. And so if they can get away with it, they'll start their companies and they'll get, you know, customers, and they'll do crowd sales or do whatever they can do without the traditional people. But there is a category of VCs who are specialized in our space. And they do get the deals when people understand like scale and startups and the idea that if they build it themselves, they will probably hit a wall at some point. And if they raise money from anyone, it could accelerate their growth. So the first people they'll go to is the blockchain VCs who have real street cred in doing these things. The tokens are an issue, right? So for us, technically, we structured ourselves where we could hold tokens and things like that. But we never, as a group, us and what I do for my day job and what I do at DGB, we'll never buy a token once it's public. So once it has liquidity and is out there and exists on exchanges, or somebody did a crowd sale already or did an airdrop already or whatever, it's too late for us.
But you'll invest through a SAFT.
So right? We will invest. So the way I like to look at it, and there's been a couple times where legally it didn't make sense, or we couldn't, the lawyers stopped us from doing it. But if I can legally participate in an entrepreneur who I love and want to back, they're doing something to change the world or doing something I think is amazing and I want to be a part of, we will do it regardless of how the value is created, right? So if they want to do it with equity, tokens, or some combination of it, we'll do it as long as it makes sense. But I usually push people to really consider delaying or not doing the tokens a lot of times. And I've learned that the best people in the space building real long-term solutions aren't usually even interested in launching a token. And if they do, it's like some part of their system for long-term value that's coming way later, because they're actually thinking long enough beyond the moment. A lot, so often, either people launch a token for two bad reasons. One really bad reason is, this is the hypey thing and I want to make money and this is how I raise money right now. And if that's why you're doing it and you don't really have a reason to have a token, you're just doing it to put money in your pocket. And that's not sustainable. That's not a business. That's not early stage startup, right? So I always say we're VC. We're doing an early stage VC model in the crypto and blockchain space, you know, no matter what. It's still that model. So I'm not investing in somebody who's looking at short term, because I need to know that 10 years from now they're going to have value, because I need I need one of my companies out of 10 to become multi-billion dollar company, right? I'm not looking to 5X in 3 days. That's nice and that's cool. But there's somebody who loses on the end of that bargain. There's probably some legal issues and problems with it. Now, the second reason somebody might launch a token is prematurely is also partly for the money, right? But they still have pure intentions, but they launch the token sooner because they go out to investors.
It's an easier way of raising liquidity.
It's less accountability. Way to raise money when markets are doing good, because there are a lot of followers, even amongst the investors, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an idiot to most traditional VCs 90% of the time, because 90% of the time we're in a bear market. And they look at me like, oh, you're still doing that crypto thing. That's cute. But then 10% of the time, I'm the crazy freaking...
That's what I get from the other lawyers.
Where I get phone calls from all of the VCs who looked at me condescendingly yesterday and go, you got any new deals? What are the deals, right? And that's how the public works too.
How's that crypto thing going for you?
When Bitcoin pops up, or when the, especially when the token markets go nuts, everybody all of a sudden wants a token. All those traditional VCs who basically thought we were crazy, all of a sudden think you're a genius, right? And yeah. And they follow the market. So I try to push people, do what actually makes the most, like convince me why a token is the best long-term strategy. And if it is, I got your back, right? But 90% of our deals are actually for equity. And because we're so early, we actually have them sign docs that that promise them in the future, if they do ever create a token, even if there's no plans and it doesn't make sense for their business today, they sign these same docs if they work with us that says, if they do create a token in the future, you're going to treat your early investors and all equity holders, including your team members and everything, equal and pro rata to how you do it. And that also makes later stage VCs and groups trust companies that might do a token more, because the biggest problem amongst people later is that they might launch a token and that token has some kind of value. And now what does the equity hold? And some companies at the early days of crypto would be like, well, the founding team hold, like you guys hold value in the equity, but now we're selling this separate thing that's a token and that's a different thing. But where are they going to spend their time and effort? Adding value to that token that's liquid or adding value to this equity that's stagnant, right? And they usually focus on the token. So if you align people's incentives, now they're aligned from the beginning. And it's kind of a bad, it's a kind of like an early stage way of us making sure if they ever do a token, they're going to treat the token or the equity right. And if the equity holders are unhappy, the equity holders can't be unhappy that they're giving love to the token because they're being treated the same way. Pro rata wise, the CEO is holding the same. So we create these things to make it easier for investors also to want to participate. But there's still legal reasons with tokens and things like that that can get in the way.
Obviously. Have you seen those mechanisms actually work? Like, have you got to the position, to the point where some of those companies have gone ahead and launched tokens and then those mechanisms have ensure that they treat those initial investors like in a pro rata equal fashion?
Yeah, I've seen it with some, actually I'm not gonna name companies because you know sometimes for they have to do like foundations in this place that launches a token versus that thing, so it's technically sometimes it's different companies, so they're not actually, but you know what,
but they honor the agreement,
honor the agreements, then you know they honor the agreement. But to me, the reason why it's important is all you have to do, it's really simple, is align the founder and the investor. Because the only time there's issues is when a founder decides, well, I haven't been taking a paycheck. This is liquid. So I'm going to give myself a higher percentage of the tokens than the rest of the team or the rest of these people or that people. And then when it becomes lopsided, that's when communities go nuts. That's when other investors go nuts. That's when problems have happened. We've never had problems like that because we fixed it, right? And we figured it out.
And that's also why it's always better. Right. And that's why that's the advantage of having a crypto savvy investor, because you're able to anticipate these things and you're able to help steer the company onto the right trajectory so that you don't end up coming to this head to head. So what type of companies are you looking to invest in now? Like, what would be your classic company that you like to add to your portfolio, and what type of checks are you writing?
So we are weird on check size in that we kind of have two models, and with our new venture studio DGB, we haven't yet raised a follow-on fund. We may or may not do that in the future. That's what we did with our first one, and you know, we probably will. I don't know, legal solicitation, nothing's been filed, so we may or may not, because nothing's set in stone, of course. We write really small checks. Sometimes we don't write any checks because we incubate the idea ourselves, where we actually have an idea.
Like a venture builder?
Yeah, kind of like what happened with Onera. Happened by accident at that point. Now we're refining that model and going, oh, I just had a really cool call with Yitzi. He has an idea for a company, whatever. It's very similar to our idea here. Maybe we create a company together, right? And we've done that a couple times in the new model, which is really cool. And when I say we don't write a check, we paid for engineering. We paid the legal fees of getting the company started. We paid for a lot of things. And sometimes it's more than we've written in checks to companies to own our piece in them. So that we do write a check. It's just from our company as an expense or, you know, whatever we're actually creating.
In the same.
And then we write a check anywhere between, you know, $25K and $100K to be the first check into a company. And those terms look a little bit, it's again, we do common shares and align ourselves with the founders. We don't do any kind of special preference. And then we do some special things in case the company ever launches a token to align ourselves with the founders. But our terms end up looking something like an accelerator, like a Techstars or Y Combinator or whatever. But we don't go through some special program. You just become a part of the family. And we have a bigger team than the average VC firm in terms of helping add value. And then we add value, right? I'm still on the weekly Onera calls. I'm on the board of Onera alongside the JP Morgan investor who invested in the round that we led, right? So we're super involved even 4 years later, 5 years later. And so we're not like those Techstars Y Combinators where it's, you know, 3 months out the door and we'll check in with you once a year, maybe, but that partner probably went on to start their own fund. So you'll check in with other people. Like it's very personal with us where we're family members, right? We're on the call. I just had a call before this with a group that we're like 5 years in together. And they're in talks with big corporate group and doing a potential big transaction, right? I'm on their board. So anyway, what I'm getting at is that's how the check sizes can be 25 to 100K, but we try to be the first check-in. We try to do something like that. Then we have the network or the ability ourselves to write larger checks as the company grows. And one of the things we do is we actually share the deals, especially when we lead them. And then if there's room for them, even if we don't lead them, we share them with our investors and our partners so that they can co-invest with us as they grow. So that's one of the things we do that makes us a little different too, right? We get to be the kind of the crypto wingmen for the more traditional folks. The companies we're looking for right now, it's like a cross between the things I'm passionate, excited about in our space and still haven't done one. Like I really want a gaming deal. That's like, we did do one that's called Hypermarket. That's they're not exactly gaming, but they provide some infrastructure for people building games to create and add tokens and NFTs to their games, stuff like that. But I would love to build or find somebody actually building a Roblox-like platform that has crypto built in natively. And I know there's some things like The Other Side, or there's some things like Sandbox and Decentraland.
Met a cool gaming company at your conference. I forget what they're called now. Action something. Ginger haired guy with a beard. Really nice guy.
I need to connect with them and see how they're doing nowadays because it's been a little while. So a lot of those companies, you know, it was hard to get off the ground, but now we're getting to a point where I think there's some interesting things. And there's people building individual games that are killer. And there's people who are building like metaverses that I think they just did the wrong model. You can't have a barrier to entry to build.
I hate the metaverse, but like,
I like certain ideas and I can tell you why, but we would spend hours talking about why gaming is important and why I play Roblox with my kids and why I think this is going to be bigger than.
But then we'll have a 2-hour episode.
Roblox is already bigger than the NFL. When I say that to people, they're confused, but I can explain why, but I won't even go there. I like that, but what we're doing the most work with are really, you know, for lack of a better word, I'm holding up air quotes because I know there's gonna be audio, but unsexy companies. And what I say by that is there's a bunch of categories in the TradFi space or that exist that if you told the average crypto person or average crypto investor that you want to invest in a company like that, they would just look at you like you're an insane person. Like, that's just not cool, right? Like prop tech and stuff like that. Even Onera, if you say an interoperability layer for private shares on a tokenized whatever, like you start saying that out loud, it sounds crazy and not that exciting. It's not the same as gaming. But these companies can launch traditionally at first, can behind the scenes be using our kinds of technology to streamline processes or make them better and be generating revenue and be a good growing company. And we're doing some of those right now, and they're very complementary to each other. Like, we have like three prop tech companies we've actually worked with, varying degrees of how much crypto and blockchain are in them on a day-to-day basis. But two of the three are generating revenue already, like 3 months in. And we created those companies from scratch. We found the founders, we're doing it with them. Like, this is, you know, just a few months in, and they're generating revenue. And we always joke in the crypto space, right? Like, there was a joke among in the bear market. Somebody else posted, I can't take credit. I wish I knew who it was off the top of my head, but they made some dumb joke that was, to me, one of the best, like, dad style jokes ever. But he said, you know, we have this legacy Web 2 feature called revenue. Because somebody asked how this company stayed in business through the bear market. The guy said, well, we have this legacy Web 2 feature called revenue. And I thought that was hilarious, because so many companies pitch us have no idea how they're going to make money, or their money-making scheme revolves around launching a token.
Nor do they care, because they're going to waste somebody else's money instead. They're not going to make it to actually having a product.
And there
they'll be in the Caribbean by then.
Exactly. In the crypto space, that, you know, we know too many of those. But in the traditional space, there's been examples, right, of those kind of things. But the companies who are the most rooted in reality, even our companies that were pure crypto infrastructure, things like that, the companies most rooted in reality, less sucked in by hype, are the ones that made it through the bear market and who are stronger coming out of the bear market and who are going to win this next cycle over.
Yeah.
Or are much more poised.
I tend to agree.
Because so many went out of business, right? And not to any fault of theirs. Startups go out of business all the time. Traditional companies go out of business all the time. Small businesses go out of business. It's a part of small business. But there is, you know, there's a certain amount of, can you scale down and keep it alive and still grow, versus we're throwing gasoline on this fire till we run out of gasoline. And then if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And if somebody's there to refill our gas tank, great. And if not, then we're out of business. That's, I don't think, a responsible way of starting a business, right? And I think we're in the innings of this industry. I have a slide that I've used in like our deck before, but I've also taken it out at different times. It's a little confusing if I'm not there to explain it, I think, where we had a slide that says no one starts an internet company anymore. And then what I say out loud is every company is an internet company now, right? That's the stage we're at in blockchain, right? Where you were still saying out loud, I'm starting a blockchain company, right? But if you were telling me I'm starting a new law firm from, or I'm starting a firm from scratch, a new law firm that has technology in its backbone to keep track of certain things or whatever, today you would say out loud, you know, part of it is a blockchain technology for immutable records of important things, whatever, right? You might say that out loud. I think 5 to 10 years from now, you're not going to say the word blockchain out loud the same way you don't say the word internet out loud or tech anymore. You used to start a tech company. You used to start an internet company. You would start a web company, right? And now a hot dog stand has a website. It's connected to Postmates, connected to Uber Eats. It's connected to Yelp and everywhere else. Even if it doesn't have its own website, you can find its menu online, right?
Yeah.
But it probably has its own website. It probably has its own Instagram. It has a web presence. They don't say, I'm starting a tech-forward hot dog company, right? This is starting a hot dog company. So that's where we are today. So in the future, you won't be starting a blockchain mortgage company. You're just starting a new mortgage company. It's a new one, right? A neobank. A neobank won't, you know, is a neobank.
It's going to become the status quo, basically.
It will become the status quo, I think. And it's where we're heading. There's going to be different flavors of it. And people will go, you know, is it this flavor or that flavor? And some people will think it's not pure tech. It's not direct to consumer. It's using a box shipper, whatever. You know, there's different versions, but that's where we are today in this space. I think it's inevitable. And not that crypto is inevitable in, you know, our day-to-day lives, but blockchain and these sort of immutable records and this idea where trust is eroded. This is trust. All you can see right now online with AI hype and everything, right? All this stuff is, how are we going to trust anything moving forward, right? We're going to need digital certificates of authenticity on every piece of content we watch because, you know,
the assumption is going to be that it's not truthful.
Yeah, 100%.
Last question.
Yeah.
You're a Bored Ape Yacht Club holder, or at least you were the last time I saw you. I don't know if you still are.
I still am. I don't see a day or that I'll ever sell at this point. Now I'll tell you why. But
so tell me why. But tell me what the experience was like. I don't know if you bought early at Mint or but if you were there through all the airdrops and if the community is still as strong as it was. And what your thoughts are on NFTs, like if you still think that there's like a market for NFTs.
Sure. So I was there early, but not on Mint. And I could have been there at Mint or so because some of my friends were telling me to mint them. And any NFTs I had until that point were experiments. And I'm talking like 2017, people were talking to us about NFT ticketing for our conference. Like
CryptoKitties and stuff.
Pre Bored Apes, my son had already minted his poopoo.eth NFTs and things like that, right? So actually, a big Bored Ape owner, one of the an early OG guys that minted like 10 or so and was like known as one of like the top OG guys, one day says to me, you know, my first NFTs ever were poopoo.eth NFTs. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? And then I realized when he used his ape and he changed his avatar and all that, he changed his name on Twitter. So I didn't even realize I was talking to the same guy. And I had known this guy already. And he was in a community for a different company of ours. And he bought my son's NFT. And he said, because I bought that NFT, I knew what an NFT was. And then when my friend said, buy the Bored Apes, I bought some of them. And he credits my son making my son's NFTs because when my son made him, he was like 8 years old. We were coming up with ideas and minting these NFTs and experimenting, right? So anyway, I didn't mint at the beginning. And when it got to like one ETH, I was like, you guys are crazy. You're going to spend a whole ETH on an NFT. You guys are nuts. And then it was two ETH, then three ETH. And I think I bought it somewhere around four. It's on chain and it was fine, the record.
But wow.
It was something that at the time, four ETH was like maybe four or five grand, right? And I was like, I woke up the next morning because I bought it. And I kept looking at them going, man, this is kind of neat, but like why? I didn't buy into the IP hype at first because so many crypto companies would have that their like kind of meme of why there's value. So I didn't fully buy in. Then I woke up the next, and then I went one night and I saw
your wife said,
ape,
you did what?
I thought
you bought a what?
she already has all the airdrops and all the stuff she knew better. Probably she actually asked me later in certain situations like why I didn't buy more of certain things, and that's the funny thing, the hindsight thing, right? But the ape, I went down the floor and I was looking at the ones at the top of the floor and I'm like, oh, some are kind of cool. And then I got to one that was a little off the floor, so it was a little more expensive than it should have been, but it was my ape. And I thought the guy looked like me. I used to own a striped shirt like that. But my glasses at the time matched pretty well, but I got new glasses that match him even better now. And I literally went, that guy looks like me. And then I decided to go for it. And I bought it. Next morning,
emotional.
Like, man, I'm an idiot. I bought the top for sure, you know? And then I
started flying.
Then I got more credit with the community, started participating with them. And I realized they had such a strong, hypey, exciting community. And I'm a big fan of, like I said, Lunar Crush, and you can measure the community, and kind of the saying always goes, there's no crypto without community. And I understood the community and the value aspect. But once it became my PFP, I was emotionally attached to it too. And I started understanding the value of NFTs and the fact that each one is unique. And me now going, do I sell this thing? But then I'll lose my exact one. It's not like a crypto token where you go, ooh,
it's like
the
an
top.
Alter
I'll
ego.
Buy back in later because I can, you know, I do like the community. So I ended up holding on to him. but I did receive all the airdrops. I got my mutants and things like that. And I probably even doubled down on some of those things too. Like I think I bought some more mutants in their drop and everything too. Then I got the land, and I've held pretty much all of it as far as I know.
And you've also
part of the community. I got to participate in certain things, and I got access to certain things, and I made money back in other ways that, like, if I'm just looking at it from a financial decision, I more than paid myself back for it. It's made money. If I would have sold it at the top, of course, I probably would have made more. I think, I don't even know, because I never really accounted for it, because it's also not my day job. And I have always participated with my few wallets as a learning curve, magical internet money, community building, and its access
to your base.
And because of that, I've been able to, you know, get certain opportunities, meet certain people, meet other investors, and have good times with groups of people that, you know, speak at certain conferences and stuff. And it's worked out for me. And I think it's totally worth it. I think the community has changed a lot, but I think that the, you know, some of the things that are being built are way more real than they ever were at the early days when it was hyped, right? Like people wanted to talk trash, you know, people outside the community, it's easy to point fingers, right? And be like, wow, like it's hype and the market and this and that. It doesn't make sense for all NFTs to be as valuable as they were at one point. And most NFTs shouldn't ever be that valuable. Just like most art will never be worth as much as some of those things are. Just like some collectibles will never be, like a baseball card, you know, has a certain amount of you know, hype around it and whatever. And I think that NFTs as a category, absolutely 1000% going to be a part of everyday life and collectibles, from gift cards to comic books to everyday kind of items that we don't even think about yet, because they're versatile. They don't have to be just an image and a piece of art, right? And the IP is, I think, really, really exciting and valuable. So I've done stuff with my Apes IP. So I'm an investor in another.
You're a great example.
What was that?
I'm saying you like named your ape. He has like his own ape, this, alter
was part
ego.
That was part of the thing, was when I got my ape, I had a podcast thing that was live, and I had a couple apes on it. And I'm like, okay, what's next? And they went, well, what's your ape's name? And I was like, and then you start creating a persona for him, and it could be you, it could be different from you, it could be like an alter ego, it could be its own thing. So I created a Twitter account for my ape, and it was going to be a separate thing. Now it's kind of like just an extension of me and kind of goofy. I named
What's
him
your name?
Strong, which is kind of like a mix between a few kind of like punk names, and gave him, the guy said, give him like a persona. So I asked, actually one of the, they told me to name him. So I named him. Then another dude was going to draw a full body version of him, because the ape only had his head, right? So I was like, oh, he has a full body. So he's like, do you want him to hold something? Do you want him to have a vibe? What's his story? Tell me a story. And so I had to make something up. So I said, there's your guitar behind you. So I literally, I told him, I said, okay, he's a old punk rocker. All of his friends got jobs, but he's the last holdout. He has no more friends to play music with. So you go into a dingy dive bar, he's the dude in the corner playing depressing songs on his acoustic guitar. And that's what I said. And then the guy drew it for me. And then it started all of these, you know, conversations and things with other people, and it turned into what it did. And then, you know, other people start experimenting with the IP of apes. So I think I think whether or not it's apes or if they have a long-term future, I think the core community, like really the people who built it and who are still there and stuff, are doing some cool things. I think people will come in and out of it, but like, you can't deny how cool it is that like
cultural revolution.
And he put him on some Skechers, right? And he licensed his IP of his ape to make money, right? And
I love that. I love it.
Stuff like that. What's the future, right? Like, what if you create a character because you're an animator, but I can buy one of your characters from you as a non-animator, but as a business person, and sell it to a production company to make a cartoon. And somehow the value trickles and I hold the IP in this thing. And it's all online, because that's the biggest issue with Hollywood and music and IP, right? And not just music, but any kind of art and IP, right? Do the writers actually get paid what they were told they were going to get paid? Or was there creative accounting? Nothing's transparent. Nothing's on chain. When the contracts become immutable and traceable and trackable, and the spending becomes trackable, there's going to be no more, you know, everyone will get credit for what they should get credit for, right? That's I think, the cool thing about what they did is, you know, they put a picture on the internet. If you look at it face value, everyone who makes the JPEG jokes, like, hey, I got it for free, right? Click save, right? That's totally, that exists. And they're kind of right in some funny ways, and it's goofy. But if you take it 10 steps further, it's like saying, you know, how stupid is the internet? It's only good for sharing websites about movies, you know, and then cut to IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, being sold to Amazon, and Amazon Video on Demand becoming Amazon Prime, coming to, you know, going from iteration to iteration, from, oh, this is just a stupid idea, to, oh, this is literally one of the biggest, you know, industries in the whole world now, right? We have examples of that in technology. The cycles are happening faster and faster and faster. So it's fun. We'll see. We'll have some fun with it. I'm holding forever as far as I'm concerned right now. I have my ape and he has his own persona, and it's a fun game.
I have the coolest thing about NFTs is the IP aspect, and I absolutely love the example of what the ape said. I have when I started my practice, I couldn't afford an ape at the time.
You got,
I was like,
you got the cool glasses too. Or no, you added different glasses. Those aren't the same one.
So I couldn't afford an ape at the time. It was like 30 ETH floor. And so somebody had taken their ape 6068 and they minted 10,000 copies of it on chain. And they said that anybody who buys one of these copies, I'm also going to give them the source files to my ape. And you could make derivatives for commercial use, and you could use my exact ape for non-commercial use. So I took the source files and I made an ape, lawyer ape, that looks like me, and I use it for marketing purposes, and I absolutely love it.
I think that's the cool thing, is like each person will get creative in their own way, right? And do their own thing. And I actually really hate that a big portion of the community, like the culture, is around like smoking weed and that kind of stuff. Like there's a lot of that. So I hate that so many of the uses of IP are for companies like that. But I think there's so many cool and fun things. Like my kids and I made a punk Ape Strong coloring book 1 year before the holidays, and we posted it online through Amazon.
I love that.
On demand, and we donated the money to charity, right? And that's
so
super
nice.
Cool, right? You know, and I love like things like what Snoop did. He put it on his Skechers, and him and Eminem did their music video with their apes and the whole thing. Like, to me, that imagination part goes, ooh, you could in the future see
I love it.
A character on a show that's one of these guys, or a show that does something like the poster behind me. We're doing this video, but I have a Simpsons poster behind me with every Simpsons character. Imagine if each one of those IPs were, or each one of those characters were separate IP that somebody could own and license, not just one group owning all of them, but you could separate it, right? And I own Milhouse, right? And maybe I could get Milhouse on a box of cereal or something, right? How cool would that be? You know?
Yeah. Really awesome.
I think there's that's how it works with like with music catalogs and movies and shows and things like that. Somebody will buy up a certain song or a certain catalog or a certain thing. Like it's going to get more granular with this technology and more traceable and trackable. And that's where I think it'd get really interesting.
Yeah, I'm with you. I have a few potential investment ideas for you. Well, I'll share them with you afterwards. Alon Guren, thank you so much for joining with me here on Beyond the Code. This was so much fun. by far the longest episode I've recorded to date, but I could easily have gone another hour with you.
We'll have you do
sure
our
listeners.
We're going to have you on our live stream where we turn the tables and ask you all sorts of legal advice.
With absolute pleasure, anytime.
And everybody in the crypto space, if you listen to this far, you probably already understand the value, but there is no category. I know there's a long, you could have a lot of jokes about accountants and lawyers and stuff like that and make a lot of dumb jokes about, lawyer jokes. But in the crypto space, especially, lawyers who know the space and understand it are worth their weight in gold and will save you a lot of money over time. I know it's hard sometimes to go, oh man, hiring a lawyer, it's just another hurdle that costs money. But ones that understand and know their worth, or that know the space, are worth their weight in gold. And I don't know, I've never used Yitzi on a deal. I don't know how much he charges, but I know him for long enough. And the reason I haven't used him on a deal is because we had somebody before, and now he's full time on another company. We can't use him anymore, so I will be calling you also
for so, thanks for the show.
but I'll shill it again when you come on. We'll do our live stream soon.
That would be great.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Code. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe, share with your friends, and to tune in again next week for more fun and insightful conversations.